Lisa and Eric Barlow connected with one another around a common calling to a simpler life among the urban poor. And during their early years of this, they felt a close intimacy with God and with one another and an exuberance about that calling. And so they married, they moved to Los Angeles, they began an internship there, and in this time, Lisa became pregnant. And they had just begun a new ministry, moved into a new apartment, were cultivating relationships and building community there, and then this is what they write on their blog. A week later, Lisa started having some back and neck pain. That night, she woke with acute pain in her neck and loss of feeling in her fingers. We drove to the hospital. Lisa got out of the car and walked into the emergency room. It was the last time she walked. Over the next few hours, Lisa progressively lost feeling and then movement in her toes, her feet, her fingers and hands, then her legs and arms. Her brain was losing the ability to communicate with her body below her neck. She was unable to sit up, unable to turn over. Her breathing became increasingly labored. And during this time, they didn't know it yet, but they also lost their baby. On the bright side, Lisa began to improve. Without the doctors even understanding the causes for what happened, she began to regain some feeling and some movement, and doctors were giving them an 80% chance that she would walk again. She continued to make progress, and they began to hope until that progress stalled. And they write, "Our hope began to fade. We felt lied to. We felt lied to by the doctors and nurses and family members who said she would get better. We felt lied to by God. Other believers we knew and some we did not told us they had received words from God that Lisa would be healed. But where was that healing? Why had he given us callings for future work that we could not do in places we could not go? What was the point of continuing to strive and suffer? We began to feel the pain of all that we had lost, and it was unbearable. We felt so utterly alone, isolated from each other by these limitations we could not overcome, isolated from our friends and family who could not understand, isolated from the God who seemed so uncaring and cold and distant." And none of us have lived the Barlow's story, but many of us have known what it is to be disappointed with God. Of course, this is one of these other experiences we don't talk about, especially in church. A lot of times we lift up all of the prayers that have come true, that have been answered the way we hoped, but we all have prayers. We've all had prayers that don't come true, that aren't answered the way we wanted them to be. The person who succumbed too early to cancer, the child who didn't make it, the interview that we had but we didn't get the job from, the dream that wasn't realized. And all of these give us this experience of disappointment. Now, whether we connect it with God, whether we connect it with prayer, we often don't. A lot of times we don't face or even consider the meaning of these unanswered prayers or these experiences of disappointment. And the longer we don't examine how these connect to our faith, they build up, and they begin to numb us to hope, and they eat away at our faith. And so this week we look at a story where Jesus meets someone in their experience of disappointment. And last week we saw how the risen Christ met Mary in her grief, and this week we see how the risen Christ meets Cleopas and the other disciple in their experience of disappointment. And there's one verse that I think communicates what it is to what disappointment is and where it comes from really well in this story. And it's that Luke 24, verse 21, where Cleopas says, "But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel." We had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. And in this verse, we see the ingredients of disappointment. The first thing you see is that there's an expectation. We had hoped. They had built an expectation about who Jesus was and what Jesus would do, and they had even invested themselves in that expectation. They'd followed him. They'd given parts, a whole period of their life to this expectation of who Jesus was and what he would do. And then there's not only an expectation, there's also an assumption. right? That he was the one to redeem Israel. And beneath that phrase, there are assumptions about what that means, what it means to redeem Israel. And they don't give voice to it exactly. But what we can tell from this is that their assumptions about what the Messiah would do, what the redemption of Israel would involve, whatever that was, it didn't involve a cross. The cross excluded that assumption from applying to Jesus, right? So they probably assumed that the Messiah would come and have a victorious battle against the Romans, and that God's promises to Israel would be fulfilled and they'd be free from oppression, right? It didn't involve a cross. And so you see their expectation and their assumption. And this is where disappointment comes from. We often assume that disappointment comes from outside of us. It's someone else who didn't follow through, or something that didn't happen the way we thought it was supposed to happen. But these things are merely triggers. Disappointment begins in our own expectations and in our own assumptions. It begins inside. And then, when those expectations and assumptions collide with reality, that's where we experience disappointment. So for Cleopas and the disciples, we see that the trigger in verse 20, our chief priests and our leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified him. This didn't fit those assumptions and expectations, and that is the event that triggers their experience of disappointment. Now, our disappointments can be small or they can be big. But whether it's a matter of small disappointments that eventually build up into something bigger, or whether it's something really jarring like the cross, our disappointment can move us into a number of things. One is that we might lash out. And we see this just a little bit in Cleopas, right? When Jesus comes up and says, "Hey, what are you guys talking about with each other?" And he looks at him and says, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place there in those days?" Right? Have you ever done that to someone? You're disappointed, and they just come up and ask you what's going on, and you just lash out with a little bit of sarcasm, right? Right? We know that experience. So we might lash out. We might lose faith. That's what we see in verse 21. They no longer believe that Jesus is this one, is the Messiah. And we might harden ourselves. We might become more resistant to getting our hopes up again. And we see this as well. Because Cleopas goes on to say, "Yes, besides all this, it is now the third day since these things took place. And moreover, some women of our group astounded us. They were at the tomb early this morning, and when they did not find his body there, they came back and told us that they had indeed seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see him." And so they have these messages, they have these witnesses that are saying, "Hey, hope, there's hope here, he's alive." But they don't know what to do with that. They're kind of hardened to this idea of hope. "Yeah, I've done that. I put my hope in Jesus, and he crushed it. I'm not so easily gonna do that again." And this is what happens when we experience disappointment. Again, whether it's a bunch of little ones or a really big one, we close ourselves off and say, no, I'm not going to be fooled again. I'm not going to get my hopes up. The other thing that we can do, and the healthy way of responding to disappointment, is that we reevaluate our assumptions and reevaluate our expectations. We allow ourselves to transform the way in which we see and live in the world. And this is where Jesus leads the disciples. And so it's important for us to see that Jesus meets the disciples in their experience of disappointment right there. But it's also important that we see kind of how he meets them, what he does. And he does really two things. The first is that he retells the story. He retells the story. Verse 25, "Then he said to them, 'Oh, how foolish you are and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared.'" Okay, so first he rebukes them, but then he retells the story. "Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory? And then beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures." He's retelling them this story that they thought they knew. And what you need to notice is that Jesus isn't faulting them for their failure to believe in the resurrection. Okay? That's not what he does. He says they have been slow to believe how this whole Messiah thing would work, and specifically that it involves a cross. It involves suffering, right? That's what he says. For them, the cross diminished the story. The cross was inconsistent with what the Messiah would and should do. And he says, not only is the cross consistent with what the Messiah would and should do, but it's necessary, right? How slow of heart to believe that the Messiah, it was necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into glory. The story goes, the narrative goes, suffering into glory. And so Jesus retells the story in a way that helps them to understand who the Messiah really was and what the Messiah truly would do. It wouldn't just be this victorious, glorious moment, that there would be suffering. And that was the path to glory. And then secondly, he re-breaks the bread. So they come to the village, and he walked ahead as if he were going on, but they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, because it's almost evening, and the day is now nearly over." And we know later that they were already starting to sense that there was something different about this guy. They want to know more. They want to be with him. And so they invite him in. And so he went in to stay with them. And when he was at the table with them, he took bread and he blessed and broke it and gave it to them. And then their eyes were open and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. And so you see, their eyes had originally been closed. They couldn't see the Messiah on the cross. They couldn't recognize Jesus for who he was. They couldn't recognize what the Christ would do, because they couldn't, because of their assumptions and expectations, they couldn't see a Messiah on a cross. But now when Jesus breaks the bread, they see in that bread his body broken. They are able to see, now that they've been retold the story and they've had the bread broken for them, they're able to see the Messiah on the cross. And so you see, it's only as their previous view of the Messiah, their previous ideas and assumptions and expectations of the Messiah are destroyed, that now they are able to see the true Messiah, Jesus, on the cross, and now through the cross with them. So what we learn from this story is that for us humans, in all of our limitations, and all of our incomplete understandings of things, disappointment is a necessary part of our faith. Disappointment is a necessary part of our faith. And this is something that humanity has struggled to accept since the garden, right? We've struggled to accept our limitations, that God sees the fruit and tells us one thing, but we see the fruit and we're like, oh, well, looks good to me. Let's eat, right? So we've struggled to accept the God's eye view of the world. My ways are not your ways. My thoughts are not your thoughts. We struggle then to accept that our ideas about God need to be shattered to make space for the presence of the true God to come in. You see, we struggle. We are slow to believe, like the disciples, that the way to life is through death, that our suffering can be a path to healing, that the shattering of our dreams and ideologies and assumptions can make space for the true God to be experienced. We want to cut ourselves off from disappointment. We want to externalize it. We don't want to change. We fail to see that the cross is necessary, that it is necessary that we, like the Messiah, must suffer before we enter in to glory. We want a God who we can enlist to fulfill our assumptions and expectations. You see, when we say we believe in God, when we say we trust God, And I was thinking about this week, what do we mean when we say we believe in God? I trust God. What do we mean by that? Oftentimes, what we mean is that we believe that God will bring about our desires, right? Oh, I'm trusting God for my healing. I'm trusting God for this job. I'm believing that God can do what I want God can do. It makes me think of that game show. Remember the game show with the suitcases, right? Deal or no deal? And you'd have a guy up there on stage and he'd have all these suitcases in front of him. And the banker would be saying, all right, if you walk away right now, you will walk away with $250,000. And for me, I'm like, this is why they never had me on the show. I'm like, okay, I got it. I'm $250,000 richer. But you always had over here on the side, you had the family and the friends. You remember that part of the show? The family and friends would be jumping up and down. And there was always one friend or one brother or whatever who'd be yelling from the side. They'd say, oh, you just got to believe. You got to have faith. And I would watch that show and I'd think, what are you talking about? What, believe that God wants you to have $1 million instead of $250,000? But that is what faith is for so many of us, that we want to believe in a God who, only to the extent that God will bring about our own desires, that God will fulfill my assumptions and expectations for how my life and how the world should be. And Jesus says, would say to us, how foolish you are and how slow to believe. Faith is not trusting God to bring about your wants. Faith is having our eyes open to the God who meets us in our suffering and in the suffering of others. And so, friends, to believe in Jesus is not just to believe that our dreams will come true, but rather that there is resurrection through death, that there is meaning in suffering, that there is light in darkness, that there is the very presence of love in our disappointment. Faith for the Christian is to believe and to trust that God is doing the same thing in us that God did in the life and death and resurrection of Jesus. That God is moving us through suffering and then eventually out into glory and resurrection. So now let's just take a moment to see what Cleopas and his friend got right. Yes, they were slow of heart and foolish in their misunderstanding of the Messiah, but here's what they get right. They just come right out with it. You know, Jesus, the stranger, comes up behind and says, what's going on? And they just pour it out. And they admit that their stories have fallen apart. They just confess, look, my assumptions and my expectations were wrong, and they've been shattered. And this is instructive for us, that we just need to sometimes get it out of there. When we've had a prayer that hasn't been answered, just be honest about it. Just share it, right? Because it's in that, it's in admitting that our stories aren't working for us anymore, that our assumptions and expectations aren't reality. It's in admitting that we then have space to re-listen to the story and to recognize Jesus with us in our experience of suffering and disappointment, that Jesus doesn't just call us to glory and vindicate all of our desires. And so through our disappointment, we get a chance to meet the Messiah that we never knew. Not the one who conquers with the sword, but the one who overcomes with a cross. Lisa Barlow still doesn't walk. Although the Barlows do have a daughter, and Lisa does have another master's degree, and they do have a ministry. But they've also written to share a little bit about how they met God in their experience of disappointment. Lisa writes, I think before I got sick, I felt like God was near me. While there was a wonderful intimacy, though, I think sometimes I failed to see the bigger picture. Through the course of my illness and disability, I think I've been able to see the longer view. God's work in the world is a big and long story, and I play a small part. I relate now more to the power and majesty of God. My faith is one of willful obedience, not the youthful exuberance that I once had. I choose to honor God, and I choose to follow Him on days when He feels close, in seasons where He feels far. When I feel safe, protected, and cared for, as well as when I feel angry and struggle to understand His purpose. She writes, I don't want to trade the ways that the suffering has matured my faith, but I do hope for the day when God feels as intimately close as He used to. Now, none of this is to say that God afflicted Lisa with her disease and disability just so she could grow in her knowledge of God. Nor is it to suggest that God afflicted Jesus with the cross. And yet, these experiences of shattered dreams and shredded attachments and disappointment draw us into the relentless love and grace of God, and deeper into the story through which God is saving us and the world. The story in which the disappointment of the cross creates space for the joy of resurrection. Catherine and Jay Wolfe have their own story of suffering, and they actually curate stories like the Barlow's story on their blog called Hope Heals. I'm going to close with a quote from them that they posted on Good Friday with this picture of Catherine in one of their really deep moments of disappointment after she had had a stroke, a very severe stroke. And as you can see her holding a cross, and they posted this on Good Friday. If the day Jesus died was eventually called good, then maybe one day our worst days might be called good too. Such is the promise of the resurrection, for Christ is risen. Alleluia.